Hello, my name is Daniel Nenni, founder of SemiWiki, the open forum for semiconductor professionals. Welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders podcast series. If you have a topic you'd like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. My guest today is Michael Ichiryu, Vice President of Marketing at Xentera Systems. Prior to Xentera, Mike was the senior executive at NetLogic Microsystems, where he played a critical role in shaping the company's corporate and product strategy. He built the applications engineering team and helped lead the organization from pre-revenue to its successful IPO and eventual acquisition by Broadcom. Welcome to the podcast, Mike.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So first, can you share with us how you came to the semiconductor industry originally?
Sure. Yeah, it's kind of a funny story. I wasn't intending to get into semiconductors. I was studying electrical engineering at Caltech. And I have to say very honestly, device physics was not my favorite class. I just did not care for that. It was just too much tedium. I was much more into the system side. And I got my start doing things like 186 assembly programming and things like that, and just doing, you know, things at the board level, system level. And as it turned out, there is a niche for that in the semiconductor business and the applications engineering side. And so once I graduated, I ended up moving to the Bay Area and joining NetLogic. I came to appreciate the device physics side over time, just because of the difficulty and all the details that are involved in making a device work with so many transistors, and just I got it later. But when I was studying in school, that was the furthest thing from my mind. And it turns out that I did a lot more of the semiconductors, once I actually got out, than the systems. So kind of funny how I life turned out.
Yeah, that's not uncommon, actually. You know, when I started in college, computers were all the rage, you know, mini computers mm-hmm. and stuff. So I actually was at the system level too. But then, you know, when it got down to it, I wanted to know, you know, what actually ran these systems, and that's how I got into semiconductors. But that's a good story. So what brought you to Xentera?
Yeah, so at NetLogic, we were working on very advanced semiconductors for routing table lookups and networking gear, things that went into Cisco switches. Basically, every network switch was using some form of TCAM, or we called it knowledge-based processor at the time. But the whole challenge with that industry was that everybody is looking for ways to add value and move up the stack. And avoid, you know, becoming plumbing. And I think that, part of what we did, at least what I did, is I started at NetLogic a program to work on semiconductors to accelerate deep packet inspection. That eventually we did get used in a number of network security appliances, and that got me kind of more interested in the higher levels of the OSI stack. So I kept moving up and up, and next thing I know, I reconnected with an old friend who had worked with me at Cisco. He was on the Cisco side of the table when I was on the NetLogic side of the table. His name is Josh Lee, and he is the founder of Xentera. And we got reconnected, and he said he was doing something interesting, trying to do security all in software. And well, that really got my attention, because if you want to talk about going all the way up the stack, that's about as far as you can go. So I decided to jump in and join when he told me what he was doing. It was just too compelling not to pass up.
Yeah, I agree. Security is one of the more exciting, especially today, one of the most exciting market segments that we track and that we cover. So what's happening in security these days?
Yeah, I think if you think about security and cyber warfare, the thing I like to think about is there's a Prussian general, Clausewitz, and he's famous for saying that war is the continuation of politics by other means, paraphrasing, of course, because I'm sure he didn't write that in English in his book. But the point is that cyber warfare is one of those things, is part of the politics. And so if you look at kind of what's happening in the world, you can see what's happening in security and warfare and cyber warfare. So one of the big stories that's happening right now is this great decoupling that's happening between the US and China. You can see it all over the board, and just the whole supply chains are getting realigned in the semiconductor industry. You know, we are seeing that just with the imposition of export controls for advanced nodes. We've dealt with the cybersecurity issue for decades. You know, when I was in Netlogic, we had concerns and issues and actual instances of espionage, industrial espionage from people from other countries trying to take our IP. So with that, there's a lot more emphasis on securing that IP. And today, especially with the the CHIPS Act coming in to help us rebuild American semiconductor industry, there's going to be a lot more scrutiny on security, and specifically in the semiconductor space. So cyber espionage is just one of those big topics that you can't get away from. But really, that's kind of the it's been there for a while, but it's reaching a higher, maybe a fever pitch right now. So, because of that, the United States and the Biden administration just unveiled a new cybersecurity strategy. It's National Cybersecurity Strategy. It's the first update to this strategy since 2018. So 5 years in the making, but there's a lot of new things in it and basically trying to protect Americans and American industry in the future.
Yeah, got it. You mentioned national cybersecurity. Can you go into a little bit more detail about that? I've heard the name, but I don't know what the latest information is.
Sure. It's a document with basically five pillars that outline the strategy of the Biden administration and what they're going to be pushing for how the government does business, how it engages with industry, and how it it's basically a roadmap to how the White House is thinking about cyber. So, I think the important parts about it are, number one, they are putting this out there as a roadmap to be transparent. They want everybody to know which direction they want to move in. They want to make industries more protected and resilient to the threat of cyber attacks. I mean, we think we've seen potentials of damage that can be done. Just examples, the Colonial Pipeline incident or the Oldsmar water incident in Florida, those are very obvious examples, but similar things in the chip sector. If chip manufacturing plant can be shut down by a cyber attack, then that's a serious concern because it constrains the supply of advanced semiconductors that are used for all kinds of things. So it's really important to pay attention to which direction that the White House is pushing. There are kind of two things in the strategy that I think companies really need to keep an eye on. Number one is the White House is pushing the adoption of zero trust security, and they're going to use contracts as a mechanism to push that compliance. And the second thing is they're going to use liability as a mechanism to secure product design. So on both hands, they're using contracts. If you engage with the government, you've got to comply with their requirements. In going forward, they're trying to use liability to make sure that if you design products with insecurities or you design them in an insecure way, then you are liable for that.
Got it. So can you talk a little bit more about those two, how they affect companies in the semiconductor industry?
Yeah, great question. So with contracts, we're already starting to see this, but going forward, any work that you do for the government is going to require representation that you're complying with cybersecurity practices. This is, even though a lot of semiconductor companies are servicing commercial business, There's a lot that do get consumed by the government as well. And so we expect that those will start to see similar kind of contract language showing up, you know, just not expanding just from the few areas that we've seen it so far, you know, to become much more pervasive. But that's the, you know, what they've telegraphed in the security strategy. And also, you can't just, you know, check a box and say, yes, I did things in a secure way. They're going to use tools like the Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative, a CCFI, under the False Claims Act, basically to, you know, say that if you have attested that you followed the White House's guidelines, but you actually didn't, and you didn't do anything, if you still got a 20-year-old, you know, design process that you didn't update, you know, to be more secure, then you are going to be liable for making a false claim. So that's one thing, you know, that could affect semiconductor industry more directly. And I think that, you know, when we look at the next couple of years with the CHIPS Act and the $280 billion worth of, you know, spending that's going to unlock over the next 10 years, you can bet that cyber requirements are going to be a big part of that. You know, the government does not want to see, you know, its funding being used to set up things in a way that is insecure and fundamentally could just cause leaks, you know, to get this information out, you know, to foreign actors or to get the, you know, put us in a position where our most advanced manufacturing facilities can be shut down, you know, with a key press. Second, so the liability part, you know, if you are going to make a product disclaimer, you know, most companies, you know, have a disclaimer of warranty, basically for merchantability, for, you know, no warranty is basically the standard default that most, you know, legal departments will set up. But if you want to have any warranty whatsoever or no warranty, you're going to have to follow secure development practices. An example of that is the NIST Secure Software Development Framework, which is NIST Special Publication 800-218. Now, this particular requirement is pretty important because you know, if you're not following those requirements, if you don't get liability, then basically you could become liable for any insecurity that's, you know, injected into your product or inherent in your product, if it's, you know, used in the wrong way, causes damages. If you didn't do your diligence and design it, take proper care to design the product in the first place in a secure way, you may not get the protections that your contract says you should. So that's really, you know, kind of an important point there, but it's really critical to make sure that your design practices are following the best practices.
Right. You know, that seems to be a lot of change for companies to adapt to. I mean, is there anything that can be done to reduce, you know, the burden for compliance?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of work to be done for sure. I think that many of those gaps are actually not that large. It sounds like it's a big deal, but most companies have already evolved some kind of best practices for product design. You know, things like code reviews, you know, design reviews, the verification processes for semiconductors in particular are very thorough. However, you know, there is a lot of work around making sure that any insecurities can't be injected into that process, that your process can't be tampered with. For example, you know, if you have you know, a global footprint with multiple data centers, and you've got many users who are, you know, logging in, maybe from home, maybe from the office, getting in to do chip design, to do software design for firmware, for board support packages, things like that, or even application software. And, you know, they have access to the code and the Verilog. I guess the question is, how do you ensure that only authorized users are the ones who have access to those files? And if somebody has access to your network, can you block them from getting into the design environment and tampering with those files? I think that you know, it's a particular challenge for semiconductor companies because there's a lot of IT infrastructure that includes, you know, very many specialized machines. You know, you've got things like build machines that have just incredible amounts of memory. running EDA jobs, you've got lab machines, they all have a potential to touch some of this IP, and that can become a vector for a malicious actor to inject something into the process. And especially with the nature of semiconductors, you know, it's not just software that you can patch and update. You know, if you manage to inject something, a few extra transistors into a piece of silicon that was sitting there, you know, would your verification catch it, and would you be able to know that thing is you know, there? That's a pretty, you know, intense example. I think, you know, that's requires a very high level sophistication to pull off an attack like that. But if you look at, you know, the fact is the world, you know, is still running, you know, processors with Rowhammer and Spectre and all kinds of other, you know, flaws that we just, it's too expensive for us to go pull out all those chips from all the systems that they're in and update them. So it's just you can't really, you just can't expect that the semiconductors you know, to get updated that quickly. And so it's even more critical to secure the development infrastructure for semiconductors. Now, in terms of, you know, what companies can do, you know, securing the development infrastructure can be a very heavy lift, because it means that you have to find a way to take the development environment and segment it off from the rest of the network, and then ensure that only authorized personnel get to that resource. And that oftentimes means just ripping up the network and moving it around. And that's really hard for an IT team, especially if they don't have other things to do. I mean, most companies don't keep extra IT personnel around just for this, you know, eventuality that they might need to re-engineer their network. So, you know, what can you do? So this is where, you know, we come in with Zentera. We help companies develop secure development environments that are completely virtualized. So we deploy security controls that can go on all the build servers, they can go on all the repositories, they can go and ensure that only authorized developers, which are employees and contractors, are able to access those servers, and also prevent the build servers from being accessed, even if you have a hacker in your network trying to access your build server. They may have, you know, direct network connection, but the security controls that are deployed as software on the build server will lock them down and ensure that there's no way for the hacker to get in. So doing things this way has a number of benefits. You know, first of all, we keep the code off of the developer laptops. That's important because, you know, if you're worried about IP leaks and things getting out, you don't have to worry about code leaking out from laptops if the code is never on the laptops in the first place. So you know, you can create a virtualized development environment where the, you know, users work inside that environment and keep that locked down so that the IP stays inside that environment. You always know where your code is. The second thing is with the build environment lockdown, you don't need to worry about hackers who are inside your network. So I think it's accepted now that even the Department of Defense is going after Zero Trust. And the reason, because even though, you know, they have all that, you know-how and budgets, they just can't keep hackers out of the Pentagon networks. So rather than trying to continue to kick those hackers out, you know, they're trying to lock things down. That's a much better approach. And then third benefit of doing things with a secure development environment approach is that it's a one-way development environment. You know, you're not leaking source code out, you know, to the internet. So even though your developer, your contractor has access to that environment, they can't turn around and upload your code base or upload your Verilog to Dropbox or someplace. So, you know, in the event that your company does get hit, or you have, you know, hackers inside your network, you don't have to worry about them getting access to the source code. You don't have to worry about the drivers for your source code, for your chip, you know, showing up on some dark website somewhere. It's very fast and easy to implement. So you can do this. We've helped customers to do it behind the scenes without impacting their day-to-day work. so that they can start small and gradually roll out to the entire company. And we've seen some customers in the EDA space go from POC to production in 3 months.
That's amazing. You know, I know that's a good software solution. I know you have some very big customers, so you're speaking from experience. But what about hardware design? Is that also covered by this strategy? And specifically, what do semiconductor companies need to be aware of?
Yeah, great question. So hardware is not specifically yet covered by the specs that are coming out of the government and the strategy that's coming out of the government. So their attention right now is on software. So basically, there's something called the Secure Software Development Framework, which is NIST Special Publication 800-218. And the SSDF basically is a list of best practices for software development. But most companies have that already. They've got things like ensuring that developers don't pull code from random repositories on the internet, put it in the code base. Those things, best practices, most companies do have that. But what they don't have is a secure development environment, which is part of the spec. You're supposed to keep your code repositories separate. You're supposed to also ensure that only authorized people have access to it. So, taking that to the limit, they actually recommend in the NIST spec to deploy zero trust controls around the entire development environment. So, but then again, that's for software. And it applies to basically all kinds of software, firmware, operating systems, application code, whether it's on-premises or SaaS code. The government actually is requiring or intending to require all companies to attest that they follow these practices. They haven't yet gotten to hardware. But as I mentioned earlier, the pain and the cost of remediating a security incident or remediating a security vulnerability in hardware is 10, 100, or 1,000 times worse than it is for software. It's just you can't update it. Even as painful as it is to update software sometimes, hardware is just that much worse. Things like the code base for chip design, there's no reason why the same practices, if it's good enough for software, it's definitely good enough for hardware. And you really should consider using that and getting out ahead of the curve to make sure that you can check that box, especially if listeners are thinking about applying for any of the CHIPS funding. This will help them check all the semiconductor security boxes so that you don't have to worry about trying to catch up with where the with requirements come out of the government tying compliance to funding.
All right. That's good information, Mike. Hey, thank you for your time, and definitely let's circle around a little bit later this year and get another update. Cybersecurity is one of my biggest concerns, and it's going to touch every one of us in so many ways. So this is a good topic.
If any of you out there would like to learn a little bit more, you can just reach out to us at info@zentera.net.
Right. How do customers best engage with you guys? The website?
Yeah, our website has a lot of information. We've got the solution briefs, all kinds of information. But again, if you want to directly reach out to us and find out how we can apply to help you with your problems, just info@zentera.net is a great way to do that.
Great, bye. Thanks again for your time.
All right, thank you.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening and have a great day.